to the Clinton Presidential Center. Let me let you know that despite my reputation as a taskmaster, I'm actually a pretty nice feller, people will say. But I'm being poked fun at from all circles, keeping you guys on track. I just know that if we don't try to do that, you guys will act like the adults that you are, or the pre-kindergartners that adults act like when you're in wide groups. So we do have a tight schedule again today, of course, despite the fact that we're starting 11 minutes behind schedule for formal programs today. Let me tell you a couple things that are happening so that you understand. We obviously have our general session this morning. This is a pretty special event, the Office of the First Lady, and I think we have five social secretaries here to talk to us about that. I think that's fascinating. Remember, make your own meaning, including those who have presidents who didn't have first ladies in office. I think that was just one, right? Just one bachelor. Anyway, second thing. The National Park Service people, they are going to have an affinity group meeting over lunch today in the NARA classroom, and they're going to bring those lunches to you. So those of you who are National Park Service people, I know that that means for the next 3.5 hours, you have to remember that. Maybe write it down or find a buddy, as we say. You'll have lunch in the NARA classrooms. We may or may not have a chance to announce that again. We are taking you, as you guys know, to and from everything this afternoon. Once we finish with lunch, we're going over to Central High School, really the seat of a very, very significant moment in American history, in civil rights history, and even in presidential history, which we'll talk about just a bit over there. We will get you there, bus you there. There may or may not be time to see the visitor center. It's very small, and we're a large group, but we'll see how we can accommodate and have a great program, and then we will get you to the Ron Robinson Theater in the early evening for a small reception and one last talk, and then one last site visit to the Historic Arkansas Museum. It's all in your program. We will get you there starting this afternoon as we go. And I think I had one last thing to say. No, enjoy yourselves. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and let Stephanie and the group come in, and Stephanie Street will take over. This is the lady who made it all happen right here. Stunning.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Clinton Center. I hope you enjoyed your evening last night and got rested up for a very fantastic day of programming here. Before we begin our incredible panel, I'd like to thank this morning's sponsor, Kay Kelly Arnold. She's not with us this morning, but Kay is one of Arkansas's leading business and philanthropic figures, and we thank her for sponsoring this morning's panel. It is now my honor to welcome our distinguished panelists and our moderator, so I'd like to introduce each one of them to you this morning. First, we have Bess Abel, who was the Social Secretary for the Johnson Administration. Maria Downs, Social Secretary for the Ford Administration. Juliana Smoot, Social Secretary for the Obama Administration. Ann Stock, Social Secretary for the Clinton Administration. Amy Zanzinger, Social Secretary for the George W. Bush Administration, and our moderator, Ambassador Capricia Penevic Marshall. I'd also like to recognize in the audience today the chairman of the Clinton Foundation, Bruce Lindsay. Where are you, Bruce, so you can wave to everybody? All right. I always have to get a shout out to your boss when he's in the room. Our moderator, Ambassador Capricia Penevic Marshall, is incredibly accomplished. A thorough review of her biography would unfortunately take up all the time we have allotted today for the panel, so I'll just focus on a few of the highlights. As Chief of Protocol for the United States, bearing the rank of Ambassador from 2009 until 2013, Ambassador Marshall was the United States' lead representative in setting the stage for successful diplomatic engagement with other nations at the highest levels. Charged with forging and managing relationships with countries around the world, Ambassador Marshall's hand was the first extended to welcome presidents, prime ministers, ruling monarchs, and other foreign dignitaries to the United States on behalf of the President and the Secretary of State. Now, prior to this post, from 1993 to 1997, she served as special assistant to the First Lady of the United States. And in 1997, at age 32, she was appointed deputy assistant to the president and White House social secretary. Now, Capricia loves to remind me that she was one of the youngest people to hold this position. And until last night, she used to brag that she was the youngest social secretary ever appointed in modern times. But we found that wasn't true last night. And she can tell you a little bit more about that. But the most important title she holds, actually, is mom to her beloved Cole Marshall, and she is one of my most treasured friends and colleagues. So I am so pleased today to present this very wonderful, distinguished panel as they discuss the role of the First Lady.
Joy is right there, honey, and she's telling you where to go. Okay. Thank you, my dear friend, for that lovely, very lovely introduction. It is such an honor, pleasure to be back in Little Rock, the Rock, as we all refer to it, in particular here at President Clinton's Presidential Library. It is an honor for me to be on this stage with these extraordinary women. You're going to be fascinated with everything that they have to say. I also want to thank Bob Beattie for the partnership in putting on all of this wonderful informational conference that you have been experiencing and yet to experience so much more. I experienced a bit of it last night, and it has been invaluable. I've had great opportunity, as many of my colleagues here have, to visit your libraries, and they all are extraordinary, offering such a special slice of our American history. We have all served in a very similar capacity for First Ladies, and each of us have brought a very different but woven in the same cloth perspective on the First Lady's role in history. And I hope that today you walk away with a new understanding of that role and how it played a very important part in our American history. I would go through and do the individual biographies of all of these wonderful women, but I think that you'll learn more about them as we get right into the meat of the questions. But let me do say this, that it was Bess Able who it was the youngest serving social secretary. She beat me by 2 years, just 2 years. So that goes right off of the page of my biography. But it is an honor to be on the stage with these extraordinary women. And so let me jump right into asking them questions, and then we're going to reach out to you. So please begin to think about some fascinating, interesting, engaging questions that you would like to ask of our wonderful panelists. So let me begin with the woman who mentored me before I started in the privileged post as a social secretary and working for the fabulous Hillary Rodham Clinton, a daughter also of Arkansas, with Ann Stock. Ann, can you give us an impression of Hillary Clinton as First Lady? Something unique that maybe many of our audience members may not be aware of.
Well, she has the best belly laugh of anyone I know. And I'm not kidding. When she laughs, you can hear it reverberating off the walls. But seriously, she has a wonderful, wonderful sense of humor. The other thing I think that I didn't see when I was reading things about her during the campaign was how much she cares about her friends and is always trying to do special things for them. Have parties, invite them in for tea, go see someone who's sick, a friend who's sick. One of her friends was sick for a year or so. She went every couple weeks to see her. And I know those sound like small things, but it surprised me because there was a warmth and a humanness that I don't think you saw come through in pictures and with her on television. So this wonderfully warm personality that just took over the White House and made it a very, very, very special place to work. So I would say sense of humor, her determination, and her caring for friends and for others, especially children.
Beth, was there something special about Mrs. Johnson that you can share?
So many special things about her. She, I have to set the stage for this because Mrs. Johnson moved into the White House at a difficult time. Now, the Clintons moved into the White House after a triumphant campaign and a huge inaugural and parades and so forth. The Johnsons moved into the White House after a tragedy in Dallas that killed President Kennedy. That was something that both the President and Mrs. Johnson were very sensitive to. I remember Mrs. Johnson saying, if Lyndon could pull down all the stars in the sky and make a necklace for Jackie, he would make it happen. But she was constantly asked, when would she be moving into the White House? And she said, there's not a lot of things I can do for Mrs. Kennedy, but at least I can serve her convenience. And so they were a couple of weeks before they moved into the White House, and Mrs. Kennedy asked the Johnsons whether or not she could continue running the nursery school. Is this an echo that we're hearing? Everybody's hearing?
It's just a little one.
Okay. Anyway, the Kennedys were running a nursery school, and for the littler ones. Mm-hmm. And the Johnson said, please continue that absolutely as long as it's convenient for you. That was the start. So they moved into a house that was covered in black crepe and on the chandeliers, on the columns out on the front portico. So it was not the way that one would choose to move into that beautiful house.
Maria, you actually have an interesting perspective on that as well, because you did. The Ford administration began
with a resignation.
So would you like to offer a bit of a background on that as well?
Well, Mrs. Ford was not in any hurry to move into the White House. She didn't relish it. She'd been in Washington for many, many years when Jerry was a leader in Congress. And so she knew what she was getting into, but she also was concerned about the children, and they were older, but not that much older. And so she took her sweet time getting there, but once she got in and got her feet wet, by the end of his term, she just really would have been very happy to stay on. And I think a lot of people felt that way. I think in the fall, I'll just digress a little bit, Capricia, and
sure.
Shut me up when you
Please,
want to.
No, go ahead. I'm fascinated.
No, in the fall of 1976, presidential campaign, you saw all these buttons erupt, keep Betty's husband in the White House. And, this just pleased her tremendously. This was a woman who had been virtually unknown 3 years before. And as I said, she did not relish the position. But once she got realized what she could do, and particularly speaking out on the issues that were of concern to her, she made some very controversial moves, but she always had the president's support for that. And a lot of those things moved on to become part of her legacy, I think, the Betty Ford Center in particular, and the problem with the breast cancer. I know I'm eternally grateful to her. I was a woman that took early detection and saved my life. So it's hard to say how many millions of people she saved, and I think that's what she was the proudest of in her years at the White House.
Didn't she also support the ERA early on?
Oh, did she ever?
That's one that was very good for me.
That, but I think that the most interesting part, and then I will shut up, was when Morley Safer did the 60-minute interview with her, and he led off with asking her what she would do if Susan had an affair. Now, Susan was 17 years old, and they just didn't ask questions like that, or up until then had not. And she was taken aback a bit, and then she said, well, she said, I would talk with her, I would counsel her, and help her to make her decision. And Safer said, well, you wouldn't throw her out of the house? And she said, of course not. But, you know, and then he went on to ask some really very personal questions of her, and I won't bore you all with them, but she held her ground and stood up to him. But the mail at the White House the next weeks after that was just horrendous. I mean, people had turned against her. It was just really a bad press thing.
Wow.
Now remember, this was 1976. That's 40 years ago when she was really up front on all these things. And the president, somebody asked the president, he said, what did you think of when you heard about your wife's comments? And he said, well, I figured we lost 10 million votes. And then he said, after I read what she said, I knew we lost 20 million votes. So wow. Yeah. Anyway, it was just, I wonder myself what some of the earlier first ladies would have thought. If, I mean, their privacy was completely blown away. I mean, there was just no privacy there at all. And this had not been the case up until then. Okay.
Oh, well, Amy, that's actually an interesting question is, you know, first ladies are conveyed in a certain way through the media. Is there, do you think, an aspect of Mrs. Bush that did not get conveyed through her official activities, through what the media portrayed her to be?
Well, I think that the media prints what they're going to print, and I think Mrs. Bush did something that I think was incredible. At the end of the administration in October, she invited about 20 historians to the first to the state floor, where her chief of staff and the curator spoke about her accomplishments, and then she had a private luncheon for them in the private residence and toured the Lincoln bedroom and the Queen's bedroom. And the purpose being that these are the historians that write about first ladies and presidents. Shouldn't she meet them? And shouldn't they hear from her what her accomplishments had been over the last 8 years?
Smart.
So that was a very special event. And I think to this day, I believe that the people that are writing about reflect on that day that she had them all into the private residence. Because as I said, they're the ones that are going to be writing about her. In the future, so.
Well, I think Mrs. Johnson had a big advantage as a first lady moving into the White House because she had been a journalism major at the University of Texas. Mm. And in fact, when she wanted to add a person to the staff that would be particularly involved with her beautification projects, she called her old journalism professor, DeWitt Rabbit, and said, do you have anybody that you might recommend that would come up and work for me? And he had the perfect person, and she got on the train, and she was there through the Johnson's time, and we still see her at lots of Johnson events, and she was invaluable to Mrs. Johnson, as was that journalism degree, because she was not, she considered the press kind of one of her. They were friends, and they did lots of trips together. They followed her into the Redwood Country. They followed her onto the space programs. And just added so much to her life as she did to theirs.
Juliana, do you have...
Technology, new technology in the White House... You know, is this working?
Okay, yeah,
it's
go.
On. You know, we had a little snafu with iPhones going in for our first state dinner. I was not part of that. But so technology is interesting in how it is used with the First Lady and with folks going into the White House. I don't know how many of you all have visited the White House, probably every one of you, have gone in. And you can generally take pictures, but for some, you know, events that are the state dinners and all, we've had folks check their iPhones and all, so we can't get pictures out prior to what we want to release, what the White House wants to release, which I think is interesting. And the press doesn't love that necessarily, but it's been interesting the way technology has changed and the way that... Yes, very fast, very fast. Mm-hmm. So...
Is there an aspect of Mrs. Obama that you think does not get conveyed through the media that is either a boisterous laugh or?
Well, I worked on the first Obama presidential campaign as the finance director. So I worked more with the president. First Lady was wonderful in doing fundraising events, but until I became social secretary, I wasn't really working with her that directly. So, and she's just so warm. I mean, if any of you have met her, she probably gave you a big hug and this big warm mm-hmm. smile, which, you know, just envelops you, and you're like, oh, you feel like mom. but she is very conscientious with your time and her time, and she's very direct in what she wants to do, asks opinions, but she pretty much knows where she wants to go, whether it be doing events, doing a policy initiative, which is very refreshing and wonderful. You know, there's no wishy-washy with her. So that's something that may not be conveyed in the press.
And what did your role in the office of the First Lady demand of you that you had absolutely no expectation that it would?
Well, we actually talked about this a little bit, but I think you know you're going to work 24/7, but you don't really know what that means till you get there, and you are working 24/7. I always tell this story that I think is indicative of how hard you work and how you're there all the time. We were doing Christmas parties, and we were about 2 weeks into it, and any of you who followed or read about holidays at the White House know that you start at the beginning of December, and you go all the way flat out, probably 18 hours a day, till about the 20th or 22nd of December. And about halfway through, I got very sick on a Saturday night, and I started this big dinner, and then I went home and, you know, knocked on the door. Steward answered the door. I said, I don't feel good. He goes, go upstairs. I'll run you a bath. You can, you know, go to bed. You'll feel fine tomorrow morning. I hear this voice from upstairs on the third floor, which is my 14-year-old son, and he goes, Mom, suck it up and quit whining. You chose to do this. So I sucked it up, I quit whining, and I went back to 24/7. But I think that all-consuming, and I think the one thing that we'd all would agree on is that the social office is actually the center of putting all the events together for the White House, the President and First Lady, with the exception of the private Oval Office appointments. So that you are literally doing, helping conceptualize the events, mediating between disputing, warring factions who want it one way or another, you know, trying to have, that would be Stephanie who wanted it one way. But we learned to love each other and coexist side by side until Bruce would weigh in with something else. But I think you come to respect what everybody in the White House does. And when you think about it, you literally are working with the Vice President's office, with the National Security Council, with the political office, with the press office, with every constituency in the White House, and then you're working with the DNC and the RNC and State Department, all the cabinet agencies, but you're trying to bring all that together. And the way things move now with events, you're maybe lucky if you have 24 to 48, 72 hours to put something together. So I think that's the 24/7, and I'm sure it's even worse with easier with technology, but harder with technology because right. You're never off.
And you also have the resident staff at some point saying, we can't, you know, we don't have the manpower. We work too much overtime in one night. So on top of it all, you do have the resident staff, and you have to be considerate of the House itself and the people running the House.
What I think I learned, I was social secretary for just 1 year, and
what I learned is it killed Christmas for that year for me, because Christmas actually started, and I think whether you're Jewish or too, it would kill the holidays, because you start in July. The calligrapher came to me, and this is sweet, sweet woman, Pat Blair. She's a master calligrapher. She's had very soft-spoken. She's like, Juliana, have you thought about the holidays? And I was like, oh, Labor Day? You know, sure. You know? She's like, no. Christmas, what we need to talk to Mrs. Obama about what the theme is going to be. I was like, oh, my God, it's July. Can't we do that in October? She's like, we're already about a month behind. So, but so that year I was like, oh, just let Christmas come and be over with. But you guys all felt that way too, right, with all the Christmas parties?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, Maria, were there any demands of the office that you did not expect at all? Office of the First Lady? You know, the Office of the First Lady changed considerably from when Mrs. Ford was there to now when Mrs. Obama's
there. Completely a different. One thing that was interesting, when I went there, I had previously been in the West Wing. I worked with Anne Armstrong, who was our ambassador to the Court of St. James's later. And Anne was a tremendous woman. We were the only two women in the West Wing. And that was a little rough. We had Ehrlichman and Haldeman and all sorts of nice people.
Those are some names.
No, I meant that nicely. They were always very good to us. But anyway, I lost my train of thought now.
Sorry. The demands of the Office of First Lady.
No. But anyway, one of the things that Mrs. Ford asked me when she interviewed me for the job, because I was closing up Anne's office after President Nixon resigned, and I got a telephone call one day from another colleague saying, Maria, Mrs. Ford's looking for a social secretary. And I said, oh, okay, give me a couple of days because I have some other things I have to take care of. Thinking because part of my job with Anne was to recommend people for appointments, for the presidential appointments. And so I thought, okay, you know, I'll start talking with people and come up with some names. And my friend said, no, I'm talking about you. And I said, oh, Lord, no. I said, I wouldn't know where to begin with that job. And he said, well, it's too late. Your name's in the hopper. So with that, a few days later, I got a call from Mrs. Ford asking me if I wanted to be considered. And I, of course, said yes. And then it was interesting because she'd been in Washington. She knew everything that went on there. And she said, one of the questions, she interviewed me three separate times, and each time was for 3 hours. And she knew exactly what the position entailed, what she was looking for. In fact, much later on, she said to me, you know, Maria, if I ever come back to the White House as other but the First Lady, she said, I'd like to be social secretary. Oh. She was very sincere about that. But it just, but one of the questions that she asked me in these monumental interviews was, I know, Maria, that you worked in the West Wing and you know a lot of the president's West Wing staff. And if they start pressuring you, what are you going to do? And she said, and you know, they can play rough sometimes. And I said, well, I can play rough. And she said, well, I little did I know, almost my first state dinner, I really got whamboed by some of the West Wing boys. But we just held our, you know, when you have the support of the First Lady, and the First Lady always has the last word, you know, you're on pretty firm ground. So we made it through that, too. But,
well, also, sometimes I think when you're dealing with the West Wing, they basically will do the, do I have to call the president to get this person on the guest list? And I'd say, yes.
Yeah,
you do.
But you know, interesting. Yeah, interesting because so many times the West Wingers would ask me advice about certain things, and I said, "Well, you know, let's talk with Mrs. Ford. She really knows this part of it and could help you." And to a man, they were just petrified. They did not want to go near Mrs. Ford. And I mentioned that to Mrs. Ford one day, and she said, Well, I didn't say anything to you because I didn't want to frighten you away from the job. But she said, just before you came on board, she said, we had a major blow-up. The West Wing was going to take over the guest list. And so she said I had to call a few of the boys into the woodshed and take care of them. So that's where I got my toughness.
I love it. That's
no,
wonderful.
She did.
How did you become social secretary, and how did then the role of social secretary function within the office of the First Lady and within the White House at that time?
Well, first of all, I came to the job from the Johnson's house because I had worked with them since, actually, I said I started that job because my husband had lied to me. Because he told me that when we got married, that he was going to build his life, not like my father had, not like his stepfather had. He was going to build his life around his hobbies and his family. And suddenly I looked up after the during the campaign in 1960, and where was he? He was nowhere. He was off traveling. He was doing advance trips for Senator Lyndon Johnson, who was then on the ticket with Senator Kennedy. And I couldn't talk to anybody above the age of 18 months. So I thought, well, I'll go down to the Democratic National Committee and see if they'll take on a volunteer. And they assigned me to the Lyndon Johnson speech writing office. So I went down there, I showed up, and I was not a speech writer, I was a typist. And it was a useless office because Johnson only gave one speech during the whole campaign. And he gave it over and over and over again. But there was mail that was coming into the DNC to Senator Kennedy, Senator Johnson, Mrs. Kennedy, Mrs. Johnson, and sometimes some mail would come in to the Johnson girls, Linda and Lucy. And people were handling the mail for the Kennedys, and they were handling the mail for Senator Johnson. But nobody was doing anything with Mrs. Johnson's mail. And I thought, I can do that. That's easy. I was used to working in a congressional office where the mail comes in today. You answer it today. So I just went down to and ordered some stationery with their 30th place address on it. And I answered the letters, signed Lady Bird Johnson, stamped the envelope, and put them in the mail. It was what I should be doing. So after the election, Mrs. Johnson called me in and said that she had a present for the baby. Actually, the baby is now 50-something, but his name is Lyndon. And the reason his name is Lyndon is because when his brother was born, Senator Johnson called me in the hospital and said, I hear you had a boy last night. I said, yes. He said, what'd you name him? I said, we named him Dan Tyler Abel. He said, too bad. Too bad. If you had named him Lyndon, I would have given him a heifer calf. So Tyler and I started thinking about that and talking about that. We thought, well, we're going to have 7 or 8 children. And that sounds like a good name. So the next baby was Lyndon, and then I didn't have any more. Well, the president, after he was in the White House, and after I was there a lot, he was always coming around with a little pad or sometimes a cocktail napkin and his ballpoint pen. And he'd say, I think this would be a good brand for Lyndon's calf. What do you think about it? I said, Mr. President, you know a lot more about brands than I do. That has the L and the A. That looks fine to me. I told Lyndon, I guess your calf died because it doesn't seem that she had any more calves. But I I was shot with love to get to work for the Johnsons because I love them. There were tough times, but there were wonderful times. And I think most first ladies probably spend a lot of time. I know Mrs. Reagan used to have Henry Haller, the chef. She would taste the food that was going to be served to the prime minister, the king, or the queen several days ahead of time to be sure that it was right. And when Mr. Johnson was asked about what were her goals and what did she think that she would be concentrating on as far as food and decor and flowers and so forth, and she said, I've had to worry about those things for 30-some-odd years. And now there are all these wonderful people here in this house. And they do that, and I can concentrate on the guest list and doing things for people. That's what you get.
Well, as you can tell, I mean, these ladies are extraordinary, and they have the best stories. On that note of doing things for people, I would like to hear from all of you. What special projects did your First Lady work on that have left a lasting imprint, either in the White House or, you know, for us within the United States government, for our country, beginning with you, Juliana?
Well, obviously, I think Let's Move is one of the biggest ones that the First Lady has worked on. And I think that you see a lot of nonprofits popping up that are supporting that in the Childhood Health Initiative, which we think is wonderful. And there are all the ongoing jokes, you know, in the White House and around the grounds, like, oh, don't let the First Lady see you eating that ice cream. But, you know, it does make you think. So that'll be something that will stay around long after they're out of office, I think.
And there's now in sort of spin-offs on Let's Move, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know from personal experience that many ambassadors, global leaders are planting gardens,
right.
And it's really started something beyond the White House, beyond the United States, even.
Right, which has been wonderful. And thank you for your help with that. Remember when we went to Bluestone? When was that Blue?
Yeah.
Bluestone Barn that we had all the spouses
in New York.
And,
it was
in New
fantastic.
York. Yeah, then we did farming and gardening with a lot of the international spouses, which was wonderful. And it's something that's very important. I could see at the Obama Presidential Library that part of a component of either a garden and a childhood health initiative being part of the programming in the foundation.
Amy?
Mrs. Bush was involved with literacy and women's health and military families, but as far as probably what you all would be interested in hearing about is what she did at the White House. She recognized that it was a home, it was a museum, it was a special events venue, and it had to be maintained. And she thought it was very important that every First Lady did their part in doing something while they were living there. And I'll never forget when the head housekeeper said to me, she said, Mrs. Bush is so great. When she goes out of town, she encourages us to do the deep cleaning and to, you know, to bring in the big ladders and whatnot. And it's everything from those very unglamorous things to painting the exterior and all the rooms that she renovated while she was there. And I think it does make a big difference because the rooms do start to get tired over time. That poor dining room rug, which fortunately Mrs. Obama finally replaced. I think it was the one thing on Mrs. Bush's list she didn't get to in the House. You clean it over and over and over again, and it just at some point does need to be replaced. But that was very important to her, to preserve the White House for the next part, and to turn it over in good shape, really,
right?
You know.
Beth?
Well, Mrs. Johnson was associated with beautification, which was such a sissy word. You never could. There were two things that she did that she just said, I hate those words, but we can't come up with anything better. But so she started in her hometown, which was Washington, D.C., and there are triangles all through the city and entrances to the city that are beautifully, beautifully landscaped. And for many years after she left Washington, she used to get a batch of letters from from taxi drivers thanking her for making their job so nice in the springtime when they drive in from National Airport and all the daffodils were in bloom. And then when she was back in Austin, well, she had another hometown to take charge of. And so she worked on the hike and bike trail that goes around Town Lake. And the mayor and the city fathers of Austin wanted to name it Lady Bird Lake. And she said, no, no, no. If you want to do that after I'm dead, that's okay. But not now. And the day after she died, they changed the name from Town Lake to Lady Bird Lake. And when I was down for the service for Mrs. Johnson, the final goodbye, and when her body was taken from where the memorial service was held out to the ranch, there were people that just lined the roadway. It was probably about an hour's drive out. And I'll never forget this one pickup truck with these two, I don't know what they were, carpenters or what, but they were there, and they had printed a big sign that they had on their truck, and it said, "Thank you, Lady Bird."
Aww.
So there were just so many people that felt so grateful to her. The other thing that she always wished there was another name for was the Women Doers Luncheons. She liked to gather a group of interesting women together for lunch, and she would have one person who would be the speaker. When she was married to the vice president, and they went off on these various foreign trips, and the first trips were all arranged by the State Department, and they didn't seem to know anything to do with the wife of the vice president except send her to an orphanage or a school or a hospital. So that first trip Mrs. Johnson came back from, I was not along on that trip, but she was just horrified. She said, you know, I'm taken into these places and a lot of press come in with me, and we're just bringing all kinds of germs in there to these really sick people. So that's what I think that the next trip after that was to Iran, which, of course, is an entirely different place than when we went there and the Shah and the Empress were there. But she said, I'd like to meet some interesting women. So the ambassador's wife invited the first woman lawyer, and she had written her marriage contract. There were a couple of doctors. There was a dean of women at the university. There was a woman who had a boutique in Tehran, and she was a designer. They were just a wonderful group of people. And I was standing in this group, and an American embassy wife came over and said to this woman I was talking to, who I think was the dean at the university, she said, what does your husband do? And this woman pulled herself up. She grew about 4 inches, and she said, I'm here because of what I do, not because of what my husband does.
That's great.
Well, I must say, every spring, and when I drive into Washington, I do thank Lady Bird Johnson for the tulips, mm-hmm. the trees, mm-hmm. the parks, and especially for the daffodils, because they just make me smile. Oh, yeah. When I think of what Hillary did, a number of things, a number of policy-related things, but I think for me, what will always stand out is something that started here in Arkansas, which was empowering women and girls, youth, underserved, and emerging leaders. And she's never stopped. And I think when she became First Lady, she took probably, 84 trips to all different kinds of countries. And one of the things that she was always insistent on is that every trip she meet with women and girls, and that at that time do a microcredit, a meeting on microcredit and microcredit loans, which also started here in Arkansas. And I think that's one of the things we laughed about when she was Secretary of State is that the State Department had only listened to what she was talking about in 1993 to 2000, empowering women and girls. They would have been in much better shape when she became Secretary of State because they had to ramp up at warp speed again. But she did probably 112 trips as Secretary of State, and every single trip had a some kind of very important meeting to empower women and girls. It could be with the heads of state. She did a lot of behind-the-scenes talks with heads of state about they have to empower women and girls or they're not going to, you know, they're not going to be able to compete in the modern-day world. So I think that has just been something that she has been consistently passionate about, not one specific project, but just that overall, that's been a passion of hers her whole life. She's not only never backed off of it, she's led the way in making other people look at what they need to do to empower their women and girls. So I think that's probably, from my personal point of view, looking at all the things she's done, and we could talk about a million policy things and a million arts and arts preservation of the house. And I mean, think about the house itself. It's a world-class museum. I mean, it's park, National Park number one. And all of the things that she did to further that, I mean, she put in a sculpture garden. She made it for the first time a non-smoking White House. And part of that was to make sure that she was protecting the priceless antiques and treasures that are in the White House. And as I think Amy and a couple other people have said, you just look at every piece of the White House to make sure that you're leaving it better than you found it, and that it is a trust that the American people give you that they need to take care of. So I think we could talk a lot about other things, but I think empowering women and girls is probably, from my point of view, the most important accomplishment, and started right here in Arkansas.
Well,
Mrs. Ford was very adamant about showcasing everything American in the White House. We were there during the bicentennial year, which really brought it more to the forefront. But she always felt, you know, this is, we have such wonderful crafts, so many wonderful antiques. And she came up with the idea of having a theme for every state dinner. And because it was the bicentennial, it felt like we had a state dinner every other week. It wasn't quite that often, but it was often. And you had, you know, we began with Emperor Hirohito and the Queen and President of France. And she said, you know, we've got a captive audience here. And so we went to the various museums. For example, one of my favorite all-time dinners was with President Sadat and Mrs. Sadat of Egypt. It was a beautiful dinner. And it was the first time an Egyptian leader had come to the United States in many, many years. Prior to his being, Sadat being in office, they had Nasser and King Farouk, and you know there just were no relationships there. But we went to, for President Sadat, we went to the Amon Carter Museum and asked him if we could borrow some of their Remington and Russell sculptures. Mrs. Ford knew that President Sadat loved everything about the American West and early America. So to our great surprise, they lent us almost their entire collection. Oh. And we ended up using the smaller pieces as centerpieces on the dining tables during the dinner, and then we scattered them throughout the house. The only person that gave us a hard time was the president. He had Bronco in his office. He said, "No, no." He said, "I don't want." And Mrs. Ford said, "Now, if we don't have Bronco," she said, "well, we're going to look awfully bad when we've got all these other pieces." So he said, "Well, I want him back in the office immediately after the dinner." And he was watching. You know, he went like this. He said. but this was, you know, we built so many wonderful relationships with all of the different museums. I remember the man who is the king of Jordan now was at Deerfield Academy, and we had he and his brother were both docents there. And I often think, I wish he'd come back to the White House so I could tell him, you know, everything that we did about it. But it was just, it was a nice experience and a nice way to show off America. Everything was American, the food, the wines, the entertainment, which got to be interesting there. But it was, that was really what she was keenly interested in, and we weren't at the White House that long, but it was a very enjoyable time.
Well, I wonder if many of you know that after a president left office, a lot of the furniture would just be auctioned off on the south balcony. So that changed with Mrs. Kennedy, thank the Lord, and she began trying to pull things back.
And established the Historical Association.
What?
She established the White House Historical Association.
Right. Mm-hmm. And she, but it wasn't firm. I mean, it wasn't there. President Johnson made that just actually in law, that the president, when he left, couldn't just round up and take things with him. and some things did filter back through the years. And,
and Maria actually continues that work at the White House Historical Association now. We're very grateful to all that you do there, Maria.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So let me now take this opportunity to open it up to the audience and to ask anyone here if they have a question for our esteemed panelists. Yes, just here.
Some of your first ladies.
Could you stand, please?
Yes.
Can you tell us, are you from a site or library?
I'm Pat Kreider, and I'm with the National First Ladies Library in Canton, Ohio.
Oh, wonderful. Remember, it started during the Clinton
administration.
Right,
yes.
I think they went out to open it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. We'd love to have her back again. Any other person.
they had a terrific time.
Yes. Some of your first ladies had been in Washington many years, like Mrs. Ford and Mrs. Johnson. Others, like Mrs. Clinton and Mrs. Obama, came from the outside. Did you see that they had a hard time acclimating themselves to that rough Washington crowd? that there was a bigger ramp up than with some of the other first ladies that had been there for years?
Well, actually, I was in my interview with Hillary. That's one of the things that we talked about. We were supposed to do about a 20-minute interview, and we did about an hour and a half. And one of the things was how to open up the White House, make it look like America, but also still coexist with the structure that is in Washington, but not really become part of it. And I think one of the things that we did early on was do small dinners in like the red room, the blue room, the green room with maybe 40, 50 people, some Washington, some other parts of the government, to bring people together to really set the diplomatic table, if you will, to hear what people in Washington are talking about, thinking about, to hear what the Clintons have on their agenda and what they're trying to get accomplished, but to really start to build. It's about relationship building. And I think if one thing we look at now that's happening in Washington is those cross-aisle relationships don't exist much anymore. And so I think part of it was trying to figure out how to make sure that you're bringing people together. And I think they were really quite successful, and we did them a lot.
Quite a bit. Yeah.
But also part of it are just simple things. You know, there are traditions that go along with the first ladies and the presidents year after year after year. And to make sure that, for example, when in the September of when Obama was running, I went to Chicago and sat down with Mrs. Obama and went through really what are the traditional events that you almost have to do, or the nation thinks you're not going to be a traditional first lady. And so if you do some of those and take some of that off the table, and then you can put your stamp on the administration, but the world looks to the first lady, and the White House is a pulpit
that they can use for that, but you've got to really think about what that is, and if you, you know, go along the way and do the traditional things, then you can put your own stamp on it. I mean, Let's Move is a perfect, wonderful example, all of the different projects. But yes, they were very aware of that and worked very hard to bring people together, but to get to know people. And I think President and Mrs. Clinton are very curious, and they wanted to know all different kinds of people, and did a very good job of bringing people together.
I think the Obamas, too, much like the Clintons, you know, having children at school age, they've been able to meet a lot of folks that are parents of Sasha's and Malia's, and they've done that. But they have to keep it the people's house. We probably could have done a better job in bringing the Washington establishment in. You all have all seen some of the chit-chat about that. But they do tend, they'll have to do some dinners and do some events, but they tend to make it more national and bring national folks in, or have, you know, dinners with historians or journalists and things like that. But Washington is hard. But I think having the girls in school, they've been able to meet some great folks that way too.
And I think that that's actually a unique perspective that both Giuliana and Anne raise, is that the Clintons and the Obama walked into the White House with very young children. And that has to be, as you know, many have reflected, the White House serves multiple purposes. But one in this case was a place to raise your child, and how do you do that with that sort of balance? I think they've done it spectacularly well. I think Mrs. Clinton was phenomenal at it, and she sought out the advice of previous first ladies in doing that. So because these young ladies are growing up really lovely. I think Chelsea's fantastic, and she's having that beautiful baby, and we're all so excited. Does someone else have a question? Yes.
Jenks, I'm from Ford's Theater, and we interpret a first lady who was very much denigrated at the time, and even still today, Mary Lincoln. And my question is, she was a very strong woman at a time when there weren't very many strong women, or at least if they were strong, they weren't strong publicly. And how has the question of the role of women, which has changed so much in the last 40 years, affected your jobs as social secretaries? Because, for instance, Mrs. Obama and Secretary Clinton have law degrees. You know, they're really professionals in their own right, and yet they're being asked to play a role that is more traditional at the same time. And so I wonder if you all would speak to that. Well, the reason I bring it up, though, is really because looking at the history as we're trying to figure out how to interpret.
Sure, right,
you know,
right.
Sure.
Well, no, I think obviously Mrs. Obama is a brilliant woman. Like I said earlier, it's she and her husband each have different styles in the way they work. But she's raising two really strong daughters, which is what her primary focus is right now. But she's also somebody that I know the president confides in getting advice. And if I had an issue, I could always go to her, too, with anything. Yep. So I think she is, she can be out, she's outspoken in so many ways. But I think she's enjoying the issues that she's taken on in the First Lady's office and in her role now. We may see that change, you know, in the next 2.5 years, too.
Well, Mrs. Johnson ran a TV station, long distance, but she, actually, when I worked for her first, I was on the payroll of the Austin TV station. But there's a lot of monkeying around of different, I needed another person working in my office, and I called my husband, and I said, could I borrow Carol, who was the secretary of his office, just over the Christmas season when we were just grounding and things. And he said, sure, when do you think I can have her back? I don't know. I said, I don't know. We'll wait and see. She stayed until Johnson left the White House. But she stayed on the post office payroll all that time. And I bet you dollars to donuts that is still going on.
Oh.
You borrow people from other agencies and you just don't send them back.
It's true, that does happen.
Yeah. Actually,
go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
No, go.
No, when we were in the White House, the tide was just beginning to turn, and women, Mrs. Ford was very adamant about making sure we invited women in their own right, not because their husband was head of this or that or the other. And then we used, and I think other first ladies had, I know Mrs. Kennedy did, we used round tables, because before that, you know, if people were seated strictly by protocol, I remember Helen Bentley came, and she was chairman of the Federal Maritime Committee, but they had seated her according to her husband's rank, and she was way down at the end. Well, you know, they all heard about it, and rightfully so. And even the introduction of the guests into the reception area, I don't know if you're aware of that, but when they are, they're announced into the state dining room and placed to get ready to be received by the president and his guests. And even then, you know, just the announcing of it, we had to make sure that we included the titles and people. But that was all very new, and I remember I was very new on the job, and one of my first calls was from Sally Quinn from the Washington Post. And she took offense with, I forget now exactly what it was even, but I ended up saying to her, well, you know, our judgment was what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And I said, that's how we decided that. But no, it started, she was very careful about that in every respect, but primarily just to make sure that we gave women their dues.
I think to follow up on that point, one of the most important roles that the President and First Lady have is that they're the moral compass for the nation, and people look to the White House to set a tone in all types of things. And so we consciously made sure that the guest list was very diverse but had more women. I'll give you a good example of Hillary at the State Department making sure that women were part of the exchanges. I was the Assistant Secretary of State for Education and Culture, which brings all of the exchanges to the United students, or not students, to the United States. And when I started, and when Hillary started, the 43% of them were women. And she's like, this number has to go higher, because I'm talking women, empowering women and girls, and you know, we need to make sure that the exchange that we say to countries, we want you to come on exchanges, but they have to be half men, half women. And so that number went from 43% to 52%, because we insisted and led by example that, you know, we wanted everybody to come, but they had to make sure that women were on their delegations. And if they weren't, then they didn't come on the exchange. So I think using that power of the example and setting the example and having the world see, and the United States see, that you're actually setting an example for others to emulate.
Another question from the audience?
Yes.
And please tell us where you're from as well.
Thank you. I'm Eric Montgomery. I operate the Wilson Boyhood Home in Augusta, Georgia. My question is there a secret manual that is passed from one social secretary to the other so that you know what to do, or do you just kind of figure it out on your own?
Don't tell them.
There's not a written manual, but we have a tradition that when a new social secretary comes in, the outgoing social secretary hosts a lunch, and we talk trash. I mean,
but and we don't like, remember anything.
It's like we don't remember anything because we have wine. But no, the thing that I think you have to know is that it doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or a social secretary for a Republican or a Democratic administration. Most of the situations are the same, which is what bonds us together. And yes, there is a small written, here's what goes on, and the incoming social secretary meets with the outgoing social secretary. But I think part of it is it really is a sorority now with a male, but he's part of our sorority. And we do exchange, and we will help the current social secretary. I mean, he can feel completely free to pick up the phone, ask anybody any question, and you're not going to read it in the newspaper. Like, it's just that kind of a very respectful, wonderful relationship between all of us.
And I was lucky. sorry. I was lucky enough, too, that when I was social secretary, Capricia, who had had the same role, was chief of protocol. So we were on the phone or emailing 20 times a day. I'd be like, oh, what do I do here? And she's always so wonderful to say, well, the Obamas may want to do it this way, or you could do it this way. I said, just tell me what to do. What's the right way? So she's so lovely. But just tell me the right thing to do.
The other advantage, not only conferring with the other social secretaries, but the resident staff is incredible, and they do not change with administrations, whether it's the people in the kitchen or the butlers or the calligraphers, and the military office gives you great support. So there are people there, and it's sort of the same thing. You ask their opinion, and they will say, this is the way historically it's been done, but obviously you can do it any way you would like.
Just be careful of that one.
Yes, that sometimes is a trap.
Get in trouble.
And so that you also have their support, which is huge.
Bess, do you have a perspective on that?
Well, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, but I'm deaf, so I miss the question, and I miss what Maria is saying. Her voice does not work with my hearing aid.
So, sorry.
So I don't know. Try me another.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you with another good question. I actually have a great question. I'm holding your bay right now for you, but I wanted to see if there was another audience. Yes. And please speak up and tell us again where you're from, name and title. We're getting a microphone to you. She's hustling on over there. Here we go.
My name is Sherry Hall. I'm from President Harding's home in Marion, Ohio.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm interested in the relationship between the social secretary and the first lady. Obviously, you spend a lot of time with the first lady, but there's got to be a line between, are you friends? Are you acquaintances? Are you just working associates? Does the First Lady confide in you at all? I mean, there's got to be a very high level of trust, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And the Johnsons adopted their staff as family. And I don't know how that tradition is with other administrations, but it was part of their personality.
Well, for me, did you want to go ahead? Well, for me, again, I had worked on the campaign, so I came from a little different perspective. And then when I was asked to be social secretary, I'd been working at another agency in the administration, doing something entirely different, international trade, so go figure. And then the president asked me to go to the reelection, the campaign, just before they left for the holidays in 2010 to go in the spring of 11. And I said, do you think I'm doing a bad job as social secretary? He's like, no, I just need you to go. I think this is going to be a tough reelect. I'd like for you to go do what you did before. And I said, okay, well, what are you going to say to Mrs. Obama? He's like, I got this. Don't worry. I got this. Well, they came back from Hawaii, and I got summoned to the residence, and he had not told her. He's like, so I hear you're going to go to the campaign? And I was like, oh, God. So, you know, for myself and the Obamas, we're friends, but we work together, too. I don't consider myself family. You might feel differently with the Bushes or...
I met the President and Mrs. Bush when he was a senior advisor for his father's campaign in 1988. So I developed a friendship with him then, long before he became president. But so I had a relationship with him. I think one thing that's interesting about the job is you are working where they're living. Mm-hmm. So by virtue of your job, when you're working on lunches, breakfast, lunches, and dinners, you're seeing them for large portions of the day into the evening and dancing and whatnot. So it's natural that you're so close to them. There is a great proximity. And then you often get a call the next morning to sort of run through what was good and what maybe could be improved the next morning. So part of it, I think, is the proximity of that you're working right where they're living.
I had a little bit of a different situation, and I think it was harder for me probably for the first 6 months because I had not worked in the campaign. I did not know the staff that was coming to the White House. I had met the First Lady in an interview, and I met President Clinton here once when Mondale campaigned for him and I was with him. So the first 6 months for me, luckily I'd worked in the White House before, so I knew the White House. But the first 6 months for me were really learning the staff, building a trust, you know, and there was part of it was almost not a mistrust, but I didn't work in the campaign. So I had to come overcome the not working in the campaign, but I can still do a job. Does that make sense? Not with her, but more with staff. Then you do, to what Amy says, you're both friends, but then sometimes you go into a staff role. So it kind of goes back and forth. But it's just an amazing experience to work for them.
And on the heels of Anne's comments, I had a different perspective because I had worked on the campaign, you know, back in the day when we didn't have cell phones and we didn't have beepers or pagers and you were just running and hustling. And still to this day, some of my fondest memories of that are of that 92 campaign. You see the beautiful black and white photographs that are out here, and it just sort of brings a well of wonderful memories back to me. And so I worked very closely with her. At the time, everyone wanted to work for the show, which was the governor, and you know, I wanted to work for this amazing first lady, you know, America's top 100 lawyer. And it was very, very close. And I was almost fired, I'll tell you quickly, on the first day that I was out there on the road, and I was doing what they called an advance job. And I was sent to Shreveport, Louisiana. And I was standing there, and I was getting the motorcade in order. We were at this airport, and I was supposed to greet, you know, Mrs. Rodham then, and escort her to the car. And we had the Secretary of State, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, and their good friend Alston Johnson. So I'm standing there, and I'm in my crisp, you know, Brooks Brothers suit, and I'm waiting for her to arrive, and I'm so excited because everyone's in perfect order, and we have a police escort. And this man from this tower goes, "Hey, lady. And I said, "Yes, yes, sir." He says, "Who you waiting for?" And I said, "Well, I'm waiting for Miss Rodham from, you know, the First Lady of Arkansas. She's coming in." He said, "We don't have no planes landing here today. We sent them all on over to the other airport." I was like, "Woo!" And so I was like, "Everybody get in the car, run." And so we're racing over because she was due to land in like 2 minutes. We get there, like, good thing that Shreveport's about, you know, 2 minutes long. And so we get over there, wait, plane lands, she gets in the car, and Alston Johnson, Stephanie knows Alston, Bruce knows Alston really well, he says, "You are the first advance person ever. I am going to tell the governor all about you, and you're going to be fired. I'm going to have you fired." Horrible. "You don't even have a watch on. Like, how do you know what time it is?" And I was like, "Oh, I thought this was going to be really fun. I'm going to be fired." And then a parade of other things happened throughout the day. They told us at this event where she was greeting the press that I had to bring a malt box. Well, I didn't know what a malt box was, and I was just like, "Oh, I don't need to do that," because they just told me to make sure that the picture was pretty. So I bunched up all of the microphones, and I put a big bow around them. And I thought, "Now, doesn't that picture look pretty?" And she walked up to the microphone, and she looked at this bunch, this flower, this bouquet of microphones, and then looked at me and looked back at it, and I said, "Okay, now I know I'm fired." But gratefully, her plane broke down, so she couldn't fly out, and I got to spend an hour with her in the VIP lounge just chatting her up and, of course, convincing her that I really was fabulous. But we had this great exchange in getting to know her, and I feel like that's where, like, the seed of my relationship was planted. And I thought, I'm latching myself onto this woman's coattails, and I am never, ever letting go. And I have it 20 years later. You know, she was special to all of us when we were in the White House. She knew the second I was pregnant, and we were sitting by the pool, and she said to me, "You have something to tell me, don't you?" And I was just like, "How do you know?" And she's like, "Don't worry. Together, we're going to work this out. And I know you want to continue doing what you're doing. I need you to continue doing what you're doing. But I also want you to enjoy this time and relish being a good mom." And while I was pregnant, she would, you know, I'd still be working for the, you know, late at night for state visits, state dinners. She'd send over a platter of broccoli. "You need your folic acid. Have you had your folic acid today?" And then when Coley was born, she allowed my mom to come in, and there's pictures of my mom with Cole in the carriage on the south grounds. She set up Chelsea's crib up on the third floor so that I could go up there and continue nursing him and taking care of him. And
She just is uniquely special that way. And she treated, it wasn't just me. She did this for so, we were all popping out babies for some reason at the same time. It was, right? I mean, yeah. Stephanie had, you know, we all were having babies. And
Speechwriter had twins.
Speechwriter had twins. But she just, she gave us all that same very special treatment.
Tell them about her inaugural ball gown.
Why do you want me to tell that story, Maria? It makes me look like a dodo. Very quickly. There is a special way in which you enter into the White House, and it's called the WAVES system. And what it stands for, I'm not exactly sure.
White House Admitting Visitors something System.
Something.
Entry system.
Anyway, it was called WAVES, and they told us that to gain access to the White House, you need to be waved in. Well, I was staying at the Blair House. All presidents, before they move into the White House, stay at the president's guest house called the Blair House, which is a treasure in our government. And so I was over at the Blair House, and at a certain time after the inauguration, I did not go to the Hill. I was waiting, getting everything organized. I wanted to personally carry her inaugural gown. I did not want it to get lost over into the White House. And then Pennsylvania Avenue had traffic, so I was like going in the traffic, dodging the traffic, carrying this dress. I don't know why I thought this was a good idea, but so I get to the gate, to the Northwest Gate, and I said, hello, I'm Capricia Marshall, and I have the First Lady's gown, and I need to come in. And the UD officers, Secret Service, looking at me like, and so, you know, and so you're not on our list, you're not on our access list. And I said, okay. And I just start waving. And I saw Mike Lufrano, this guy, and I'm waving to him. I'm like, hey, Mike. And he's like, hi. You know, and I'm like, no, I'm waving to get in. And meanwhile, everybody else is kind of going in. I'm like, what do I have to do here? And it finally dawned on me that that was not going to give me access to the White House. And so finally, someone came out and had me cleared so I could bring her dress and hand it to her, which then got lost. And then we had to go and try to find it. It was... You know, it's funny, when you first walk into the White House, it's so immense. You think, oh my gosh, how am I ever going to figure this out? And by the time you leave, you think, this is so small, we need another room, we need another ballroom, you know, to do what we have to do. Special times, special relationships. Another question? Got to be, yes, over here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you so much for this very exciting panel this morning. I'm Mary Ann Peek, and I'm National Park Service Superintendent for the Adams National Historical Park in Quincy. Abigail Adams was the first lady to move into the White House. So we celebrate that every day. I have a very curious question. What about weddings from the White House? I know the Johnson girls were married from the White House, and I believe the Nixon girls around the time Nixon was president. So could you speak to that for us?
This is about weddings in the White House, and in particular the Johnson girls' wedding at the White House, if you want to speak to that.
Well, it was a wonderful experience. So, and I didn't have a wedding myself because my husband and I eloped. So every once in a while when one girl or I would be talking about something that might happen or could happen, and she'd say, well, what did you and Tyler do? Oh, now I remember, you didn't do anything. So, but it was, there were two entirely different weddings. Lucy wanted to be sure that her dress was perfect, and she couldn't envision, like her sister could, she couldn't envision a drawing or imagine a dress fitting her. So we went to Priscilla of Boston, who made wedding dresses and bridesmaids' dressing, and Priscilla was wonderful, and she picked out a dress, and Liz Carpenter, who was the Mrs. Johnson's press secretary, took on the job of trying to keep Lucy's dress a secret, because Lucy didn't want Pat or anybody else to know what she was wearing until she walked down the aisle. And there were a lot of people that were making that difficult for Liz, but it finally got pretty good. And one night I got a call from the president. He had, I think David Dubinsky was with him, probably in his bedroom that evening. And Mr. Dubinsky was the head of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And he had come to the president because he was very, very hurt that Lucy's wedding dress was being made in a non-union shop.
Oh.
And so the president's calling me at home, and he said, if there's a mistake to be made on this wedding and you haven't made it, it's because you didn't think of it. There were still some other mistakes to come. I said, well, I'll talk to Priscilla in the morning, and I'm sure that we'll work something out that'll make you and Mr. Dubinsky happy. I love Mr. Dubinsky. So the next morning I called Priscilla and explained the situation. And she said, it's not a problem, Beth. I promise you, there's a bridal house that's in the same building as my workroom and my office. And I've already talked to her, and we're going to work. We're going to make another dress, and it will have a union label in it. And we'll send you both dresses at the same time, and what you do with them is up to you. So I always thought when I clipped that union label out of one dress and sewed it in. Brides are supposed to wear something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue. Linda's wedding was much easier because it all happened in the White House, and because she worked with Jeffrey Bean on making her dress, and he also made the bridesmaids' dresses. So,
I actually have a wedding story. As you know, Jenna Bush got married in Crawford, Texas. She wanted something very small and away from the limelight of the White House. But shortly after the invitations went in the mail, Mrs. Bush called me and said, "I think we have a problem." She said, the wedding in Crawford is so small that even very few relatives are being invited. And as you all know, the Bushes have an enormous family. She says, we're going to need to have a separate reception. So it was a private event at the White House. About a month after Jenna was married in Texas, we had a reception at the White House where she was able to invite the more extended family and school teachers that she had taught with and more of her husband's family. And we recreated the wedding cake and the flowers, and we all agreed she probably shouldn't wear her wedding gown, as it was more of just a reception. But we sort of semi-recreated the event at the White House for a reception. It was a lovely event. So it was a mini number two.
We did a wedding in the White House, which was Secretary Clinton's brother. Tony got married to Nicole Boxer, who is the daughter of Senator Barbara Boxer from California. And the biggest challenge for both Capricia and me, because we were working very, very closely together, was that it was working through both the bride and the senator. And there was always this discussion with the bride, then the discussion with the senator, then the discussion back to us, and we finally got it all together. But they did a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful wedding in the Rose Garden with probably, 500 people? Mm. And dinner and dancing in the East Room afterwards. But Hillary was just so wanted her brother to be married in the Rose Garden, and it was really one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. But it was just that negotiating was something I hadn't bargained for.
Another question from the audience? Yes.
Tom Schwartz at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library Museum in West Branch, Iowa. We are currently having a First Ladies exhibit, and I want to thank my colleagues here for their cooperation and helping make it a really terrific exhibit. One of the stars of the show is Mrs. Hoover's 1929 custom-built Cadillac from the Detroit Motor Company.
Oh, wow.
She broke convention by driving herself with, she didn't use a chauffeur or a driver, and by all of the written accounts of people who were passengers with her in her, her motoring exploits, said she had a lead foot. The newspapers both criticized her for being undignified in driving herself around town and passengers without an escort, but others saw that as an example of kind of independent spirit. And so I'm wondering what kind of guilty pleasure that the first ladies may have exercised that in some ways defied convention. And here I'm having specifically in mind that iconic photo of Mrs. Ford, I think in the cabinet room.
What is this, Maria? Share this with us.
Well, there's a photo that's been widely circulated of Mrs. Ford on top of the cabinet table in the cabinet room. And I'll never forgive David Kennerly. But what happened was this picture was taken shortly after the election. And I remember Mrs. Ford saying to me, you know, Maria, this place is awful. Everybody around here is just going with their head down and moping around and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I thought there had to be something to cheer them up and to get them out of that doldrum. And so she said, you know, we were walking around, and she said, I saw the table, and I jumped up on the table and started doing a dance. And Kennerly, I think, prompted it a bit. You know, he was like very close to the Fords. He was like a son to them, actually. And I think they loved him, and David obviously loved the president and the first lady very much. But I think the photographer's gremlins got the best of them that day. Yes, and I remember Mrs. Ford saying to me, I guess I shouldn't have done it. She didn't say, I'm sorry I did it. And Kennerly insists, you know, she wanted to do it. But it's one of the most popular photos.
But it's a beautiful photo, and she was a Martha Graham dancer.
Yes, she was.
Anyone else? Guilty pleasures?
I don't think I should comment on that right now.
I don't think any of us should.
Well, one thing that we did enjoy is during scheduling meetings, they were also sort of a time to try new goodies from the kitchen. And so Walter Scheib, who was the chef, would bring up a variety of tasty treats that we would indulge in and you know during our scheduling meetings. So
Capricia remembers that. Mm-hmm. I remember Hillary coming in with a stack of letters and a yellow legal pad with about 50 things on it.
We all
it was
had
like
a task.
Tick them off. We all got tasks that we had to go out of there and do.
Pistachios. We ate a lot of pistachios.
Yeah, I had a guilty pleasure that went along with every state dinner. I always did the seating for a state dinner just a few hours before because people might have to cancel or we added people. And I would close the door, and the people in my office would make these round discs, and we had little arrows, like, with everybody's name on it. And I would put the president's table, Mrs. Ford's table, and then start while the cabinet people would host a table. And then I would go through the list, and I claimed to do this because I knew almost everybody that was coming to the state dinner, and of course, with the official party traveling with the president, you just did them by rank. But I remember one day in particular, and I would laugh, and the door to my office would be shut, but my staff always said, "We could hear you howling in there. You were getting your revenge." But I remember the other night I was at the Ford Foundation, had their meeting here, and I saw General Scowcroft, who was the president's national security advisor, and just the most capable, the most beautiful man ever. And I remember whenever I'd have a difficult person, I would always put them at General Scowcroft's table because he's such a... Well, Kissinger was something else. but this one particular dinner, and I think it was a French dinner, For some reason, there was a person very high up at the Washington Post who had taken a real offensive against the woman who had been invited from a French woman, from American woman, but from Paris. And they were doing this campaign against this woman. It was almost like annihilation. And I got to feeling sorry for the woman. You know, she didn't need me to feel sorry for her, believe me. But anyway, I thought, okay, I will seat her at General Scowcroft's table. I will seat the Washington Post hierarchy lady at the table, and I put the general right in between the two of them.
Brilliant.
And when he came out of that dinner, the poor guy was real. And he looked at me and he said, "Thanks, pal." So he remembered it. We talked about it the other night.
Okay. Well, I'm getting the let's wrap it up sign, unfortunately, because this has been a wonderful time. On behalf of the Clinton Presidential Center, again, I want to thank our esteemed panel here of social secretaries. They hold a revered position like their first ladies in our nation's history. These are unique stories that only they can tell. And so I want to thank you all so very much for sharing them with us today.
Thank you, Patricia. I think it's a good job, Patricia.
Well, thank you, Capricia, and thanks to all of you fascinating women. What an incredible panel this morning, and we're so grateful. Well, I get to do Bob's job of sort of giving out the scheduling instructions. I have a little experience in that. And I don't have my glasses on, so I'm going to try to read this. I think next on the agenda, we have two breakout sessions. One is Connecting the Nation to White House History, which will be here in the Great Hall, and the other, Hanging Out with the President, Using New Technologies in Presidential Education, and that will take place in the Choctaw Building here across the way. And then afterwards, those sessions will all return here to the Great Hall for lunch. So thank you again. Thank you to you incredible women, and I hope you enjoyed this fantastic panel. Thanks. I just messed it up. I told you the wrong places. The switch, the two sessions, the one I told you over there was here and vice versa. So thank you to whoever wrote this for me. Appreciate it.